February 26th, Bedouin Soundclash takes the stage. February 7th sees Busty and the Bass come to town. And on February 19th, it's a special Wednesday night rock show with headliners Dear Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
Cold weather getting you down? Warm up this season with amazing hot food to go at Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen foods to prepare at home and enjoy a huge selection of meats, cheeses, produce, coffee, beverages, and condiments. Pop into the shop Monday through Saturday between 8 and 5 at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF. To get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints on today's show. Cannabis impaired driving is on the rise in Winnipeg.
Some people don't feel the effects right away with the edibles.
Winnipeg, where Muslim and Indigenous communities unite to inspire systemic change.
And I think people are, in general, really committed to the collective good and really trying to figure out a way to lift each other up and to ensure the dignity and humanity of all people.
Canadian composer Eric Lankin launches his first classical music project, the Icarus album.
Despite the grief and the tragedy, it is a celebration of Icarus on both sides of the veil, from the living and the afterlife.
Seniors are meeting up in Waterloo to talk about travel at the Friday Flicks Travel Show.
People are not interested to stop and hear a lecture. They want to see the pictures. Our audience wants to not only enjoy the afternoon and meet other people, but they also want to learn something.
The cities of St. John and Moncton bid to co-host the 2029 Canada Games.
It makes for an opportunity for both communities to share the opportunity, also share the risk of hosting something like this.
Queen's County athlete Abigail Smith will join Team Canada's European Judo Tour.
It's crazy to me. I didn't think it was going to happen. It's really exciting.
And our solar system will again put up a great show during the Great Alignment.
Right now, we are at the right place at the right time, right? Gotcha. And we won't be able to see that for over 50 years again, so this is rare.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and thank you for being with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassagne. I'll be with you for the next half hour and in good company. Our national correspondents are feeding us great stories this week. First up, out west, the Winnipeg Police, in collaboration with Manitoba Public Insurance, just launched a road watch drug-impaired driving enforcement initiative. Running from January through March, the campaign targets drivers under the influence of cannabis and other substances. Constable Peterson explains that another aspect of the campaign is to increase awareness of how cannabis, particularly edibles or ingested cannabis, affects the body. The risks associated with edibles stem from their delayed onset. They can take several hours to peak. This delay can lead to overconsumption and an overwhelming level of impairment. Details with Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
You know, when it comes to cannabis impairment, we are seeing a constant rise.
Running from January through March, the campaign targets drivers under the influence of cannabis and other substances. According to the Liquor, Gaming, and Cannabis Authority of Manitoba, the sale of cannabis edibles has nearly doubled since legislation in 2018.
When it comes to edibles and products in general, cannabis products, we're seeing, you know, that the numbers keep rising quite significantly and very concerning to us in that sense.
The risks associated with edibles stem from their delayed onset. Unlike smoked cannabis, which affects users almost immediately, edibles can take several hours to peak. The delay can lead to overconsumption and an overwhelming level of impairment.
And what we've been seeing through some of the studies that and training that we've been receiving is some people don't feel the effects right away with the edibles. They may take some more, consume some more to feel the effects. Now, only in a few hours, it all of a sudden kicks in and it's kind of an overwhelming effect that they receive.
Constable Peterson says the Winnipeg Police Service has increased officer training to detect cannabis impairment with the use of standardized field sobriety tests and approved drug screening equipment to evaluate drivers. This equipment includes oral fluid tests, which detect recent oral drug use. Last year's enforcement project yielded 243 traffic stops, 148 oral fluid tests, 43% tested positive for cannabis, 36 Provincial Offenses Act notices, including unlawful storage of cannabis in vehicles and passenger consumption. The Winnipeg Police Service is spreading its message through social media, press releases, and public outreach. While specific educational efforts in schools were not confirmed, the broader goal is to initiate conversations at home and among young drivers that impaired driving is a year-round concern. I'm Ryan Funk.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
Ryan Funk, who has also produced a piece on how the Winnipeg Muslim and Indigenous communities unite to inspire systemic change. This, as the City of Winnipeg hosted its first Muslim Indigenous Solidarity Conference, with the two-day event divided into several panels and discussions on the impacts of colonization, ongoing discrimination, allyship, and reconciliation. In this excerpt, Ryan spoke with Leah Gazan, Member of Parliament for Winnipeg West, and Dr. Ingrid Mattson, London and Windsor Community Chair of Islamic Studies at Huron University College.
You know, we can't look at our oppressions in isolation. It's important right now, particularly with the rise of extremism, for people to work together to ensure human rights for all peoples. You can't pick and choose when to uphold human rights. We are in a human rights battle right now, and I have confidence in humanity that human rights will prevail at the end of the day.
But what we'll find instead is if we do put effort into understanding what is happening to other people who are being oppressed, we put a little bit of that effort and then we listen to them and stand beside them, what we find is often our exhaustion starts to lift. We start to feel energized because now we found someone who understands, who can sometimes help share our burden and we share theirs.
It's not just two communities here. I see actually a very diverse audience, and I think people are in general really committed to the collective good and really trying to figure out a way to lift each other up and to ensure the dignity and humanity of all people.
Listen to the rest on frequencynews.ca. You can also find on Frequency another story that we could not fit into this episode of Viewpoints, but it's well worth the listen. A 22-minute documentary about the Canadian classical music composer Eric Lankin, who just launched his debut work, the Icarus album, at the Waterloo North Mennonite Church, a place with deep connection to the composer's family. Lankin says he composed this album as a metaphor for losing his father to mental illness. Here's an excerpt of that 22-minute documentary from Dan Keller in Kitchener, Ontario.
I'm Eric Lankin. I grew up in Kitchener, Waterloo, lived for a time in Guelph and a time in Hamilton, and have been based in Montreal for the past 6 years now. I'm a composer of new classical music. I am a political troublemaker, and I'm someone who struggles with mental health and manages to function very highly, despite living with bipolar. So I created a new classical music album. It is called the Icarus album. It's an instrumental album in the sense that there's no lyrics or vocals, but nevertheless, it's very narrative, and it combines performances by some of Canada's best classical soloists, certainly Montreal's best classical soloists, and it also features sound design that I made with the great Devin Bate, who is easily one of Canada's most important producers. And so the album, for me, is inspired by the myth of Icarus. Icarus is a character who I've always felt drawn to ever since my diagnosis of bipolar. He's a common metaphor for living with bipolar in the sense that you cannot fly too high or the sun will melt your wings, and you cannot fly too low or the water will wet your wings and you will fall into the ocean and die.
Intriguing, is it not? A beautiful music from the Icarus album by Canadian composer, now based in Montreal, Eric Lankin. In an early review of the Icarus album, critiquer Robin B. James of V-Glue magazine wrote, "This amazing work of Eric Lankin creates a new triumph, which I would place high in the pantheon of significant human musical expressions."
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
So how to transition from such a beautiful music? Should we talk about traveling to foreign countries or about the solar system? Well, we'll do both. The Friday Flicks, a travel show program hosted by the City of Waterloo at the Community Pavilion, is drawing crowds of 120, 150, and even up to 180 people at a time. They gather every other Friday afternoon to listen to a presentation about someone else's travel story. The program has been running for well over 10 years, and in the last few years has really begun to pick up steam with 2,400 attendees in 2024. Journalist Leah Gerber spoke with Sarah Kelly, who organizes the program for the City of Waterloo, as well as longtime participant, volunteer host, and presenter Rick Chambers about the program and what exactly is drawing all these people together.
We often stop for at least half a day in San Jose, the capital, and it's not a remarkable city, really, but it does have a couple of features that are worthwhile seeing.
Janice Bach is wearing a microphone headset and slowly strolling through a seated crowd of about 150 people on a Friday afternoon in Waterloo. The room is packed. Bach is a featured speaker for one of the City of Waterloo's programs called the Friday Flicks Travel Show. It's all about people coming together to listen to others' travel stories. Sarah Kelly is a programmer in youth, adult, and older adult programming at the City of Waterloo who organizes the program.
For 2024, some of the shows were Dubai, exploring the desert and the UAE. A few of them were on the Canary Islands. We had a show on Denmark and Copenhagen. We had one on Portugal. We had someone that was celebrating their 40th wedding anniversary, and they went on a European river cruise. So then we got to hear all about the castles and cathedrals and medieval villages from Amsterdam to Budapest. We had shows on Italy and South Africa. We usually have at least about 80 to 90 people that pre-register. We are almost at, like, when we're up to 180, we're almost at max capacity, so we're almost at the point where we have to turn people away.
In the last few years, Friday Flicks has become massively popular. In 2021 and 2022, the program attracted 875 attendees each year. 2023 saw 1,300 attendees, while 2024 saw 2,400, and there's no sign of it slowing down. Kelly says, on average, each show attracts about 120 to 150 participants. The highest she's seen is 180 for one show, and that was about a bird-watching trip to South Africa. The group meets every other Friday from 1:30 to 3 p.m. at the Waterloo Memorial Recreation Complex Community Pavilion. Rick Chambers is a volunteer host and presenter for the program. He's been attending for about 13 years.
Since I started in 2012, I've made over 50 presentations. What makes a good presentation is keeping the pictures going. People are not interested to stop and hear a lecture. Like they want to see the pictures, they want to hear your stories, and you know, and humor doesn't hurt as well, to throw in some things, and help them see what you learned from this, because people, our audience wants to not only enjoy the afternoon and meet other people, and it's a social outing, but they also want to learn something when they're there. So it's a it's an intellectual and educational pursuit, as well as a social gathering and entertainment.
The program started as a group of people getting together to watch nature and National Geographic-style documentaries and movies over 10 years ago. Then it morphed into attendees sharing their own traveling experiences. Now, a featured presenter will share a prepared presentation, which is followed by socializing time with treats and coffee.
I'm on the City of Waterloo Age Friendly Committee, and I'm also on the region's Age Friendly Network. And, you know, one of our great concerns is social isolation for older adults. Get them out, get them doing things, and get them socially engaged and intellectually engaged. And I think that's one of the things that the Friday Flicks Travelog does.
I'm Leah Gerber.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
And during the next few weeks of February, we will again be able to turn to the sky and observe its magnificence and wonder. Some of us got to watch a solar eclipse in 2024, and 2025 will provide us with another celestial show. The Great Planetary Alignment hits our screens. It's a rare celestial sight visible in our night sky, and the next one will show up only in 2040. Malar Kendekar, the president of the Prince George Astronomical Society, has spent a few orbits viewing the cosmos through the lens of the Prince George Observatory. Kendall Carr says the phenomenon should remain visible until about mid-February. Kendall Carr recommends looking at the southwest and viewing the planets through a pair of binoculars if we can, as they greatly amplify, of course, our ability to see Uranus and Neptune. Here's Ian Gregg in Prince George, British Columbia.
The Great Planetary Alignment is when all the seven planets are visible in our night sky. So all the planets actually orbit in a path in our solar system in a three-dimensional way called an ecliptic, right? So every single planet orbits in an ecliptic path. So most of the time you won't be able to see all seven planets in the evening sky at the same time. So this is a rare event. So of course, as we know, celestial mechanics of every single planet is their orbital period of each planet is different. For example, Jupiter's orbital period is about 27 years or so. My numbers could be off. But the first planet, which is in our solar system, is the Mercury, which has the shortest orbit because it's so close to the sun, and Mercury is also tidally locked to the sun. So that planet takes about 88 days to complete one orbit. So you will see Mercury just after the sunset, just at the twilight. And then you'll see Venus, which is the brightest planet in our sky right now. It's, I think, the absolute magnitude is minus 4.6 or so, right? which is really bright. So in astronomy, okay, Everything is really weird. The negative meaning the objects are really bright. Positive means the objects are really faint.
Interesting. So one aspect of the significance is that seven of these planets are visible in our night sky. And the other aspect is that they are in alignment. You actually can look up and see them in a...
That's right. So when you think about an alignment, we think as a straight line in one dimension, right? But we are looking at the solar system, so the sun and the moon, they are in two-dimensional order.
So that's how we perceive them from our point on Earth.
That's basically right. For an observer, it's two-dimensional, and then when we're looking at other planets, it gets into three-dimensional. So the planets are always aligned in our solar system because they're following the same orbital path, which is on the ecliptic, but the difference about this one is they will be visible because their orbit right now, it's in such a way that they will be actually visible in our night sky, all the seven planets, including Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. All those seven planets will be visible. So right now we are at the, you know, we can say right place at the right time, basically. Right?
Gotcha.
And we won't be able to see that for over 50 years again. So this is rare.
So make sure you take a look up at the sky starting January 24th through to...
So right now, just after the sunset, you will be able to see at least four or five planets. 25th, January is just the date that someone decided that's going to be the best view.
Okay.
But is it really true? No, unfortunately.
Okay.
Right? So they have been kind of visible for almost 10 to 15 days, and the visibility will actually get better as Mercury will be kind of above the horizon and not really, you know, very close to the horizon. It will be about 20, 25 degrees above the horizon. So at that time, you will be able to actually see all the seven planets. You will get a good view of that.
Okay.
So you will see it at least until the end of February, all the seven planets. So you do have a lot of window of opportunity to actually see all those seven planets. One thing you have to be mindful of, you won't be able to see Uranus and Neptune with your naked eye, because those two planets are quite far away. And I mean, if you do have a good eyesight, you will be able to see Neptune and Uranus. I have a terrible eyesight, so I can't see them. But yeah, even if you have a small pair of binoculars, there are lots of applications for Android or iPhones like Skyview, SkyMap, StarMap. So you can actually point your phone in the night sky and get the exact location for all the planets.
You can kind of ID where in the sky you should be looking and then bring your binoculars up to that point, and there's a pretty good chance you're going to see something.
That's right, for Uranus and Neptune. And for other five planets, they're extremely bright, so it's really easy to see those planets like Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, Mars will be really red. So another thing to notice about the planets when you're looking for the planets in the night sky is the planets won't blink like other stars do because of the atmospheric turbulence. So even in the low atmosphere, even there is a high air mass, the planets won't blink because we are looking inside our solar system, and they're much more brighter as compared to the stars, because they are, you know, thousands of light years away.
Simply further away.
That's right. So that's a great way to look for the great planetary alignment.
Right.
Yeah.
In your time volunteering and working with the observatory, do you have a favorite celestial event that you've witnessed? And do you think that this event might actually eclipse that?
There are so many, honestly. And over the years, I have seen or discovered gamma ray burst, supernovae, tidal disruption event, meaning a star getting sucked by a supermassive black hole.
Wow.
It was all CCD, like taking images systematically of the entire night sky, and then we look for these transient events, right? That's one of the research that I do. But from the observatory, one of the cool things I've seen is a comet, which I think was in 2020, C2020F4, also called as Neowise, that was visible to the naked eye. And then just last year in November, we had another comet called Comet Atlas, C2024Q4, that was also visible to the naked eye. So periodically, you will get all these really cool comets that you can actually take photos of, or sometimes even the comets will be visible to the naked eye as well. But this event is a rare event because we might not be able to see it again in our lifetime. So looking forward to seeing some of the planets that are visible.
Excellent. Visiting us from the Prince George Astronomical Society, Mr. Malhar Kendekar. Your time and expertise are very much valued.
Thank you.
Thanks for cluing us into this celestial event.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
The cities of St. John and Moncton are hoping to host the 2029 Canada Games and submitted their bid to the Canada Games Council. If the bid is successful, 2029 will be the first time St. John has hosted these games since 1985. Journalist Yono Ko spoke with the bid committee's co-chair based in St. John, Bill McMacken, and with Andrew Beckett of Envision St. John, the growth agency responsible for economic development, about the process and the interaction between the two cities, as well as about what the games will ultimately look like.
It's essentially New Brunswick's turn to host the Canada Summer Games. Last January, the province kicked off the bidding process. We are doing a comprehensive bid document. We will hear about that in February, and they'll do a site visit. And we should know in early April that it's official. We've had really positive feedback from our community partners, from our municipalities in both regions. There's strong, strong support in the St. John region and the Moncton region for this. So we think we're in good shape. It makes for an opportunity for both communities to share the opportunity, also share the risk of hosting something like this. And it allows us to take advantage of the best assets between the two regions and pull together a really regional approach in Greater Moncton and the St. John region, which is going to, I think, result in a really positive event for the community.
Our feeling in terms of doing it collaboratively was that there's ways to better utilize existing assets in both areas to minimize the amount of capital investment that's going to be required and deliver a product that was going to be really good for the athletes that are coming, beneficial to the entire province. I think there's great opportunities for us to be doing more in collaboration with whether it's Moncton or Fredericton on other things, but we just, rather than being in a win-lose situation, we think there's an opportunity for both communities to do very well through these types of collaborations. The operating budget for the games is in the $35 to $40 million range. A good portion of that, about $10, $11 million, is paid for by the federal government. The province will be putting in $7 or $8 million towards it. Local municipalities have agreed to contribute $4 million, and then there's a whole fundraising part that goes along with it. But so it's a fairly big undertaking. These are great community-building events. People still talk about the 1985 Canada Games when it was here, and it's a great way to build community. Events like the Canada Games provide a really interesting space to bring people together in a joint celebration.
These interviews were conducted by Yona Ko in St. John, New Brunswick.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
I do not know if the 11th grade student Abigail Smith will take part in the 2029 Canada Games, but I can tell you, though, that the Liverpool Regional High School student will be competing against judokas from other countries yet again as she prepares for a tour of Europe with Team Canada in March. Smith will be traveling to Spain, Portugal, and Croatia for European tournaments and training camps. The 17-year-old Brooklyn Queens co-resident, who began judo lessons when she was 4 years old, is ranked in the top 10 in her age division in Canada. Smith will have to juggle travel, training, and tournaments with school and social life. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, reached out to Abigail Smith.
So I've traveled with Team Canada one time last year, which was for an event in Germany. And like, I was so excited for it. And now I'm going, I got selected to be on a tour, which is an even bigger deal. And I didn't think that would happen for me this year at all. Like, my main focus was, oh, I need to win nationals. But like, now I'm going to three different countries in Europe for a, spending a month away in Europe. Like, it's crazy to me. I didn't think it was going to happen this year. It's really exciting.
She said she's looking forward to the more intense competition of the European tournaments.
The training is really, like, for me, it's like the most important thing, getting to train with different bodies. Like, being in Canada, you know everyone that you're training with, and you're not getting familiar with different fighting styles. But getting to go outside of Canada and train with these, have these camps, like, fighting round after round with people from all different countries all over the world, it's the experience, you're getting so much experience from it, which is going to make my judo like way better, and I'll see big differences. Tournaments in Europe are a lot different than tournaments in Canada. There's a lot more aggression, there's a lot more people who want to win, so I'm getting so much experience because judo is my life. Like, the thing I love the most is judo and everything that comes along with it. So like, for me, doing all those things, like sacrificing time with my friends, like, I want to go to the Olympics, I want to be world champion, I want all these things, and I know that the goals I want and that I've dedicated so much time to, they're not going to come true unless I keep with it. So I keep with it. And my friends, everyone in my life is so supportive. They're like, no, like, go train, we'll make time later. Like, they're always, they know I need to train. My family, my friends, the community, everyone's so on board with everything I do. It makes it 10 times easier.
That was Abigail Smith speaking with Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia. And this is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our many journalists, Ryan Funk, Dan Keller, Leah Gerber, Ian Gregg, Yona Koh, and Rick Conrad. And to our national editors, Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Welcome back to Plugged in My Ears. We have Sam and Kyle with you this week. We've got a lot of blockbuster news. There's been some pretty big movement in the NBA, although I will say I'm not a really active follower of the NBA. I do definitely tune in once in a while, and I'm definitely on top of some of the big trades that happen. I didn't know about this until Sam told me, though. Luka Doncic has been moved in the NBA. That's a crazy blockbuster trade. Maybe Sam has some more you can elaborate on that than I have.
Yeah, it's a little bit interesting. So there was a little bit of speculation going on for a while that Luka Doncic might get traded. And then all of a sudden rumors started appearing on social media, notably X and on Reddit, that Luka Doncic had been traded to the Lakers. And there was absolute radio silence from the Lakers. A bunch of ESPN reporters, TSN reporters, Sportsnet reporters, etc., reached out to the Lakers for commentary, and they said nothing for a long time. And then out of nowhere, all they did was post online saying, "The NBA can be crazy. Times are wild, man." And then the next post was just a picture of Doncic wearing a Lakers jersey. That was just crazy. And basically, in return, Dallas got a first-round draft pick. And then, honestly, two guys who are okay, not like amazing. They might end up being good in the future, but right now they're just not there. This is kind of shocking the NBA a little bit, because Doncic wasn't really seen as the type of guy to get traded, and I don't actually think that Luka wanted to trade. Most people don't think he wanted to trade either. And it's just weird. This is a bad decision for Dallas. They don't really get anything in return. CBS Sports called this an A-plus win for the Lakers, because they gave up literally
arguably the best active player in the NBA.
Well, one of them, yeah. Nikola Jokic is probably, I think Nikola Jokic is probably the best player right now, which is, and maybe Wembanyama, but Wembanyama is probably the best rookie, obviously.
Yeah.
But Nikola Jokic has been an unsure, but still Luka Doncic is like a ridiculous piece to add to the puzzle here. And I almost feel like this is like a mirroring situation with the Kansas City Chiefs, where it feels like, you know, the league actually just wants to see something happen with that team because it just makes them so much money that it's almost like the league itself has like a pretty large investment stake in one team. And I feel like that's the case of the LA Lakers. They definitely, I mean, think about how much money that there would be if the LA Lakers were having a great playoff run. Like, that's, they got a lot on the line for that.
Yeah, they do. But what was weird about this, too, is that this was a three-way trade, I should say. Mm. The Jazz were also involved. And because of that, the Mavericks, so Dallas, did get Anthony Davis, which isn't that bad. Mm. But still, this outrageous trade. But yeah, the big topic really is what LeBron and Luka might be able to do together.
Yeah. No, I mean, the big wonder is, you know, what do they do with Bronny?
Yeah, there's, I don't know if there's enough couch space for Bronny anymore.
Yeah, I don't think he's coming back, but... Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
There's not that much to say. Like, just this, only this can happen in the NBA. I'll be pretty critical of the NBA here. That league has the most sellout players of any professional sports league in the world, except for maybe soccer.
What? I think because they don't have cap limits, right?
It's just different the way it works.
It's more flexible.
Like, yeah, it's far more flexible.
Because like in NHL, like or some other leagues, like, you know, it's just. You're limited by cap space and it's quite strict, right? So when you take on new players, like, it's pretty hard to move big pieces like that without like having to give up a lot of players because you need to open up space. Whereas in the NBA, it seems like they have a bit more flexibility with cap space, and I guess their cap space is so much bigger, so they have.
And they also carry less players too.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's also just lower cost fees to run and all that. So yeah, there's more mobility because of that. You can buy out a player.
I think also a lot of teams in the NBA don't max out their cap hit, right?
Yeah, and part of that's because it's kind of hard to do that as well.
Yeah, so it's, the just, best players, it's just too high. Yeah,
like, the best players are just going to go to better teams anyways.
Yeah, it's too high, right? So and it definitely makes the NBA have some like super teams and then not great teams, which is pretty weird because in the NHL, for example, like there's no such thing. Like there basically is no such thing as like a super team and then like a there's some bad teams and there's some good teams.
That might be changing, though, now that they're trying to increase the salary cap. So for those of you who don't know, next year, I believe each team gets an additional $8 million in salary cap. Then the year after that, an additional $9 million. And then the year after that, an additional $10 million.
Mm. So, I mean, they're saying it's combating inflation, which is true.
Yeah. I think the inflation's been pretty serious. Adding another $27 million to the cap over 3 years is kind of nuts.
Yeah, but if you think about, okay, you know, there's the inflation. If you want to beat inflation, you have to be rising 15% about a bit more every year.
Yeah, so, you're right.
You know what?
Yeah.
It actually is pretty reasonable.
Yeah, I guess it is. I guess it is.
But, you know, it feels like a lot, right? It's kind of crazy that it changes that much. I mean, I think the NHL is just trying to make sure their players are satisfied.
Yeah, well, they want to keep as many people as possible. Right now, they got a bit of a problem because if you're a low-end NHL guy, but you're still good enough to play in the NHL... Honestly, the perks of going to play in the KHL in Russia or going to play in the DEL in Germany or the SHL in Sweden are like, it's better than potentially playing in the American Hockey League or even being a fourth liner in the NHL. And so I think a lot of this is a response to that as well, especially because it's getting kind of hard to bring Russian players over because they make so much money in Russia anyways. Like, I think the average salary in the KHL is about $3 or $4 million. In the NHL, it's about $6 million. But if you're a bad player here, you're a good player there, which means you're on the higher end of that spectrum.
Yeah.
So it is, I think that's a lot of it too.
The only thing I would say is that, you know, these cap space things disproportionately impact Canadian teams because, you know, Canadian teams they pay different taxes, different tax rates. So a lot of sports teams, let's just say like, you know, Dallas, for example, like, you know, Dallas Stars, they benefit greatly from the fact that they pay less taxes as players there. So it actually means players are more inclined to play at a place like that because they get to keep a larger percentage of their salary. So they can actually take lower contracts but make more than they would with a higher contract in Canada. So that's been controversial for a while because it basically means that, like, Canadian teams operate on like a significantly smaller operating budget than American teams, or some of them at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point to mention as well. That's one of the reasons why a lot of players choose to go play in the States too.
Yeah.
Because their capital gains tax is lower. Although actually right now, because of the political situation, there's also no capital gains tax in Canada. So
yeah,
it's a little bit interesting. But on that note too, though, something that almost never happens in sports, it was experienced recently in both Ottawa and Toronto. The Toronto Raptors played the Los Angeles Clippers, and the Ottawa Senators played the Minnesota Wild. And during the American National Anthem, in response to these, we'll call them Make America Great tariffs, the stadiums erupted in boos to the Star-Spangled Banner. And what our British friends and former, I guess, relatives are calling a rare moment of indecency from the most decent fans. And, you know, the cherry on top of the cake is that the Senators won that game against the Wild 6-0 too. Which is perhaps any indication of how things might be going. But it's just wild. And so that, too, is going to have an impact on the NHL, realistically. I mean, the cost of living is going to go up quite a bit, and it's going to be difficult for people to fork out the type of money they typically pay to go watch games. Obviously, this isn't really going to impact teams like Montreal and Vancouver and Toronto the same, because, quite frankly, those people who are buying tickets don't really exist. Most of its corporations are already very wealthy people. But for teams like Ottawa, Winnipeg, Calgary, Edmonton, this is a different story. Money doesn't, you know, fall from the sky. These are hardworking middle-class people who are going to watch games, and they're the ones who are going to be the most affected. So that also is going to have a huge impact recently too, or more recently and soon, because of the fact that teams just aren't going to have the same type of money to pay players. Like at the end of the day, they can only pay players the cap maximum, the cap limit, if they have the money to do it. And ticket sales go down, well, then they turn into a team that's like Arizona and have to move.
No, and entertainment industry is definitely at the whim of economic ups and downs. A serious economic downturn would be pretty negative on any sports league, really. But NHL will definitely feel it. You know, am I really surprised by the booings at the game? Like,
I think that's to be expected.
No. I mean, I'm surprised it wasn't louder.
Yeah.
But, I mean, maybe that's because the Sens mean it wasn't full. But I can assure you that the booing will be significantly increased at the Four Nations event. And it might cause some problems. I can't really predict what's going to happen, but I could see the tensions being pretty high.
Well, I'll just say one thing on that topic, and then perhaps we'll move on and get out of too much of the politics. But former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien very rightly said that for the first time in Canadian history, the French and English Canadians all share something in common, and that is their distaste and disgruntledness towards their southern neighbors. And so in many ways, we're more united than ever. And I'll just to resonate on that note, I agree. I think the boos might, they come a little bit harder with a French accent, I'll put it that way. But
yeah.
On that note, maybe we should talk about the Four Nations Cup. It's seeming like Sidney Crosby is going to be the captain of the team. Kel McCarr just called him Captain Canada the other day, and with good reason, I would say. He's the most decorated player to ever wear a Canadian jersey at this point in his career. So, I mean, that's a bit of a separate conversation too, but I mean, what do you see? What do you see the leadership team looking like for this Canadian national team?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the other thing I was speaking about earlier about the Four Nations is that I've actually been under the same misconception as a fan in the past pretty frequently on these kind of events where you go into it thinking it's going to be really structured, just kind of like the All-Star game or, you know, those sort of things. Like, you think it's going to be more structured than it ultimately ends up playing out to be. And it turns out, not to say it's going to be like a shinny game, but, you know, especially as defensemen, you know, you have a very specific role, and on your team, you train for months, if not years, on that specific role and how you pivot on the ice and change with your other teammates, and it's very set out, strict, kind of firm rules, and that stuff doesn't happen overnight, especially with all-star players, because they're very strong personalities in the ice, right? They mesh pretty well, but anyways, my main point is that usually the defense and kind of those sort of super set plays just tend to not be as, like, structured as you'd expect in these kind of events, so I just think that the defensive side and maybe the number of goals scored is going to be quite a bit higher than regular games, just because that's just how it is, right? Like, you're playing with new players and you're kind of having, hopefully having some fun. So it's a little bit different. And I also think that the goalies tend not to put 100% effort in.
Yeah, that's one thing I noticed too.
Like, well, I mean, it makes sense, right? There's a lot on the line. Like, if you're Connor Hellebuyck, like,
why would you get injured for this?
I mean, his team probably even told him, like, the Jets are probably like, yeah, you're not allowed to, like, go all out and, like, tear your groin for, you know, a Four Nations game, right? So I think there's a bit of that. I don't think, I mean, that's obviously they still try pretty hard, but I think in the back of their mind, if there's a play where they, like, think they could hurt themselves, like, they might pull themselves back and just not go for it in the sense of, like, trying to avoid a serious injury. Obviously, it can still happen, but I think they're just a little bit more cautious than normal.
Yeah, and rightfully so. Although it'll be interesting to see because, you know, with All-Star games, there's a lot less on the line. But I do think for this Canadian national team, there's a lot of pride on the line at this moment because of everything that's happening politically, but also because of the fact that the U-20 World Juniors team performed so poorly.
Yeah.
So that's also something that's playing into it, too. But just one thing I want to bring up, which is kind of an interesting stat. I didn't know this. I just found this right now. So despite the fact that I already mentioned this earlier, that Crosby's the most decorated player to ever wear a Canadian jersey, this stat here will blow your mind. Canada has won 25 straight games in tournament play with Crosby in the lineup, having not lost in 5,461 days since a 5-3 loss to the United States in the preliminary round of the Vancouver Games on February 21st, 2010. In that same tournament, he scored the golden goal in the finals against the United States. I don't know. It's kind of cool. I think there's an argument here that Sidney Crosby is in the top five greatest hockey players to ever wear skates.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
Where would you rank him on the list there, the top five? Or where would you rank him on the global list?
I think, you know what, I have to say, I think in terms of, I usually think of players in terms of influence, right? And I think he's been someone that has pushed the game forward in both a positive way, but his impact has been huge, right? Like he's brought so many people to hockey, I think the most out of anyone. And that's not to say like he's overshadowing Gretzky or something. I just think because of, you know, the internet and, you know, TV was more accessible when he was playing. But I think Gretzky was like really someone that opened up the game like a lot. Like I'm sure it's hard to calculate numbers on how many new hockey players he generated, but I'm sure it's huge. I mean, obviously same with Ovechkin. And I think that them two kind of played like a similar role at the same time there. But no, he's been like an inspiration to Canadian hockey fans and kids for like decades now, right? So I think that's kind of hard to measure. So for me as a Canadian player, I feel like he's definitely easily in the top five for sure, even in the top five player of all time, no doubt for me.
I think what's unique about him, and it speaks to your element of considering an influence, that he revolutionized edge work in hockey. No one moved on the ice like he moved on the ice before he came around. And that's why we see guys like Connor McDavid and Cale Makar, who are so shifty and so fast. Sidney Crosby ushered in that new era of high speed, high agility, and high mobility on the ice. And I think he will go down as the greatest skater of all time. Not the fastest, but the most agile for sure. That to me is...
Well, I mean, I think he's someone that just loves the game, right? Like, you know, he absolutely loves playing hockey. And any time he had a weakness... You know, when he first started playing, he wasn't a big guy, right? Like, he was kind of, I wouldn't say, he was, like, a bit on the thinner side. He wasn't he's not a very tall person either. Like, he just wasn't very big. And he had a lot of problems with that. He couldn't really be physical. He just didn't have the weight or the skill set, really, to just throw his body around. And he worked on that. He got a lot stronger, a lot bigger. And I would say now he's definitely more of a physical presence. And he's just done that with every aspect of his game, right? Like, he just changes and adapts to make himself the best player for his team in any given scenario, basically, like, which is what shows, like, was a really good captain, but also just a really good player, right? Like, a player that just was willing to, like, change his game for the betterment of his team, not just himself, every game.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a special guy.
And he's actually playing very well right now. He's actually had a lot of points in the last this season and the last couple of games. So he's coming in pretty hot to the Four Nations.
Yeah, it's it's funny you say that though. At the end, like, I'm just thinking of all of, like, the cool things that have happened in the history of Canadian hockey, and arguably one of the most significant things ever is the Golden Goal. And he's just like so humble. A reporter asked him the other day, where he placed his goal on the list of most significant moments in Canadian hockey. And he said, "What do you mean?" And they're like, "Well, don't you consider your goal to be the most historic Canadian goal of all time?" And he said, "No, it never even crossed my mind. I thought that was Paul Henderson's in the 1972 Summit Series against the Soviet Union." And I was like, "Yeah, you know what? This, like, he's not only is he good, but he's like, he's very humble and self-aware." And honestly, I think some people would actually argue that Crosby's goal was maybe more historic than that.
I mean, again, I think it just goes into, I think Paul Henderson's is pretty major. But I think his was, again, this more exposure. So
yeah,
I think it had a larger impact. Yeah.
Agreed. That's what I'm saying. That's what I mean as well. I just think Crosby's really humble.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. But on that note, too, a lot of the Canadian guys are coming in pretty hot. McDavid's doing pretty good right now, too. He's starting to really get going.
Yeah.
Cale Makar is doing pretty good. McKinnon's on fire also. And one just has to wonder, though, if there's almost too much firepower.
I mean, I think I'm actually pretty happy with the team they made. I know some people have had some criticisms of, like, some of the picks, especially, like, defensemen, like Parayko. I think Parayko's a great player. I'm not really sure I understand the criticism there. I think he's a very good defenseman. And he's more of a defensive defenseman, which I think this is what they
we do need wanted, one of those, right? Yeah.
So I'm not really sure I understand the backlash on that one. Bouchard, I don't think he should have made it. Like, he's a good player and all, but Makar is filling his role, right? So
yeah. And I think really, Makar, I think it's fair to say that Makar is the better defenseman.
There's no argument there. So, I mean, that doesn't really surprise me. I mean, I'm pretty happy with all the picks. I think...
Are you surprised Hyman didn't make the roster, though?
Not really. Hyman's a good player, don't get me wrong, but he's not, like, a standalone player.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, he does make... Don't get me wrong, he makes his own opportunities fairly often. Like, he does score, like, rushes and other things, but... You know, if you look at his numbers and his stats, like, he scored, like, over 90% of his goals in the blue paint last season.
Yeah, most of which came off Draisaitl.
So, I mean, like, you know, that takes a lot of skill, but at the same time, like, I feel like you already have some finishers in that team. Like, you've got Sam Reinhardt, who's definitely a finisher. Like, and everyone on that team can bury the puck. Like, you got Crosby, McKinnon. Like, there's just so many guys that can bury it. I don't really see why you need Hyman. Like, if someone got injured, maybe. I don't think he'd be bad. I just think we had so many options that...
Yeah, there's almost too many options. It's a good problem to have.
Doesn't make sense to have him.
No, it's a good problem to have too many options. But on another note, maybe return to the NHL, are you surprised to see that Ottawa's actually in third place?
Yeah, Ottawa's been playing well.
Shockingly. Even though Brady Tkachuk's been not good.
No, I know. They won a bunch of games, but their offense, they weren't decisive games, except for the one last night was pretty decisive against the Minnesota Wild. And that being said, the Wild have been good, so that's a statement game for sure from the Sens.
Huge statement game. That doesn't really happen for them that often.
I have to say, though, like, this is how well the team should have been playing the past couple of years. Like, it's kind of almost surprising that they weren't this good last season, right? It was surprising. It totally shocked me. I mean, it didn't make any sense. You looked at the team on paper, and they have quite a few good players. Like, we've got a lot of players that are sought-after players. And last season, we had tons of guys that should have been producing and that just didn't seem to mesh. It's still the same worry for me with the Senators. It's just they need... that structure, like, they just, I know that they've gotten improved, but they just really need a great defensive structuring, which they've worked on and it's gotten better, but it's the special teams for me. And the special teams have never been more important than they are right now in hockey, with so many teams that have, like, lethal special teams. You cannot be lagging behind on that if you want to win any serious games. Like, it's just not going to happen. You cannot have a special teams, especially the power play, just because, you know, if the team knows your power play is weak, then they aren't even as scared to take penalties. And that's a pretty major problem to have if you're playing, like, a serious hockey game where the other team is not afraid to take penalties against you because they know you can't do anything with them. You're not going to enjoy the style of hockey that's going to get played against you if you have that, right? You need to have, like, it's hockey's still a mental game, and if you can't even scare the other team with your power play or anything else, it's going to be a problem. So I think they still need to work on some team chemistry and getting the power play really rolling. It's been better, though. They've been producing some more goals. Some of their top scorers have been in and out a little bit. You know, Brady Tkachuk went 10 games without a point, which was pretty long stretch for him. That's like one of the longest of his careers, actually. So,
well, he had a few points yesterday, though.
Yeah.
Two
goals. You know, but something weird from last night, he had no hits, which for him is like a total fluke, right? And that makes you wonder, maybe he's getting grilled by the coach to switch his things up a little bit, but I don't know. So that's one of the first times, in, like, you know, a handful of times in his career where he's had no hits in a game. So
that
was a fluke game for him in a couple of ways, I guess. But, and Norris is, I don't think he's injured. He's a day-to-day right now, so he'll probably be back soon.
Yeah, he will be back soon.
But, we had a couple guys that have been, Norris has been injured a couple times already this season, right? So I think if everyone stays healthy, the Senators look pretty decent. And I think we'll secure a playoff spot, actually.
There's a good chance, but we have to take into consideration a few things with that, too. Ottawa is in third in the Atlantic, but they're only a .577 win percent.
Yeah. The Atlantic's quite weak, I have to say,
like,
actually.
It's pretty bad. Like, you know, wild card guys are not far off at .567, .569. Mm-hmm. Ottawa's one more point than Columbus and two more than Tampa Bay. Obviously, those guys are fighting like for metropolitan spots.
I think
but.
Tampa Bay is not to be discredited or forgotten about. I think they will be a presence for sure. Columbus Blue Jackets is actually a weird one. I don't know if anyone's been watching them play, but they have a very good first line. Kirill Machenko has been phenomenal. Like, he's a very good player. He's been producing over a point a game. Very good player. And Adam Fantilli has been
very
quite
good
a
player.
Bit. He was having some struggles, like kind of early rookie problems,
which is normal in fairness.
Yeah, and then I think he's finally found himself a little bit. Like, he's been producing more consistently and decent volume now. He had a hat trick, his first hat trick ever, not that many games ago. So he's looking good. But I think it's more just the idea of, and you know, who can forget Werenski? Werenski has been unbelievable in the Blue Jackets, right? So they've got a couple players that have really stepped up in the Blue Jackets, and they're looking pretty nice right now. I would say, though, the problem with them is it's isolated to kind of just one line. Mm-hmm. That's their first line of defensemen and forwards. So they're pretty one-dimensional.
Which will come to bite them later on in the season, too.
Yeah, the playoffs, that wouldn't go very well, but I think they have a more promising future, or at least they have some big pieces they can move around and get some stuff for that. So I think they have a good outlook in the future. I think they still have some prospects and future picks, so they're not looking too bad.
What do you think about the Bruins, though? They're kind of depleted of players.
I mean, I think a lot of people, if you look at what last season was, like, logically, like, it was kind of a fluke because they shouldn't have been as good as they were. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it had to do with some players that were undervalued and stepped up. Like, you had Jake DeBrusk, who was not getting paid much on the Bruins, and he was kind of like a bottom six player. Mm-hmm. He was stepped up for sure. And they had a lot of those guys that were depth players that seemed to step up. And that doesn't always happen on those teams, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. you don't get that. So I think they got lucky with that. Once they lost those guys, had to sign some new contracts. And I mean, Swayman's just not looking too hot. I think the combination of those things, it's just pretty rough for them.
Do you think Brad Marchand's been a decent captain, though, since his appointment?
I wouldn't put this on Brad Marchand. I think he was...
I think he's been playing fine, actually. But
I don't think he's been playing bad at all. I think it's just their depth just got sucked. Sucked from them. They don't have the depth scoring anymore.
I think for the first time... I think for the first time in 30 years, they're going to have to go through a rebuild.
They were kind of due for one, actually. Like,
it's really been 30 years, like, literally.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of how the NHL works. It's very cyclical because it's so heavily controlled. So once you don't have enough prospects feeding your team every year, you kind of start to fade away a bit because you don't have pieces to trade or ways to sustain your team cheaply, right? Because the only way to have a really good team in the playoffs is having some good players that you're not paying a lot, right? So, it's mostly to do with the cap.
The issue with that, too, is that as those players start to get good and as their contracts start to expire, you then realize you got to start paying them more. Mm-hmm. But I guess that's sort of the value of being a good drafting team, which I think Boston actually is. Boston's pretty good at drafting. They're not cursed and plagued like Ottawa and Edmonton are. Well, actually, Edmonton plus.
Ottawa's actually a good drafting team, but they just, we don't have, they don't,
we have a really bad retention rate on our, yeah.
retain our players.
The attrition rate's crazy.
Yeah, it's
not, like 60%.
It's pretty bad, yeah. But usually we like to trade our players just before they peak. Right, yeah. Before, you know, you kind of, it's, you know, we
or buy, as they peak.
We buy high and sell really low. It's like, that's kind of the Ottawa motto there. But I think we've altered that a little bit nowadays. I think Ottawa also used to not spend the full cap hit. So we were below cap hit. We're kind of a budget team. So that was definitely not helping.
Eugene Melnyk wasn't inclined to spend a lot of money. He preferred to save and hope that the players would just be good and want to stay. Although, as we saw with Hoffman, it's a little bit difficult.
In February at the Broom Factory, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local favorites. On January 18th, don't miss Canadian alt-rock